My name is Vern Rieke. I teach at the University of Washington School of Law. And as I've said once before, once upon a time I was a real lawyer. But for the last number of years I've been an academic lawyer, teaching rather than practicing. The disciples of Christ once said to him, after he had been engaging in some parables, and they had him alone, "Now, no more of these parables. Just tell us what really you're getting at. Don't hide the absolute nature of your instructions anymore." And our Lord had difficulty explaining to people that our call is to live in ambiguity. It's part of making decisions about problems where the answer is not clear. Jane, a few moments ago, shared with me something she had just heard on a tape, that love is not an emotion, it's making a decision. And for me, of course, those of you who have suffered with me on prior sessions know that ultimately I have to take these things down and talk about the goats. After we've seen the glory of everything in the sky, it comes to the question of who gets the goats. And that's not always clear. I'm going to try and illustrate that. It's the 18th chapter of Luke, beginning at the second verse. It's one of those "how much more" parables. And he was telling this parable, saying that there was in the city a judge who feared not God, neither regarded man. It's a judge who made up his own mind about things. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, "Avenge me of mine adversary." And we don't know what her problem was, and we don't know whether she was right or she was wrong. She simply came in and asked the judge to help her in a problem that she thought she had. And he would not, for a while. But afterwards he said within himself, "Though I fear not God, nor regard man, yet because this widow is bugging thunder out of me," oh, those are my words, not here, "yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me." And I still don't know whether she had a good cause of action or not a good cause of action. I only know that she continued to put her case before the judge and insist that he do something, and finally he said, "You're wearying me, and in order to get you out of my hair, I'll do something." And he apparently helped her with her problem. And the Lord said, "Hear what the unjust judge says." And then Jesus concludes this parable by saying, "And shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear with them long?" I take it that the point of the parable really is that if we continue confident that God will help us and let God know what our problems are, that ultimately we get helped. And I also know that most parables, especially those "how much more" type parables, really have only one hook in them, only one point, and it's not fair to press other things, and I will now do something that's unfair. I want to know why this judge gets called unjust. You know, all of a sudden Jesus says, this judge is unjust. Is that because his motivation was doing something because it let him sleep better? You know, he was tired of hearing this woman griping all the time. So he pays no attention to God, nor he pays no attention to the law, and he just does something that satisfies himself. Is that what unjust means? even though maybe it was the right result, if there is such thing as a right result? Or is it because it was a wrong result? And I don't know. I only know that I find my Lord here telling me to pattern conduct, is it, after something which is unjust? Or isn't that in that parable? Law school teachers sometimes say that they are like a lighthouse. And we say that because there is a story about a Native American who, an American Indian, Native American, who encountered his first lighthouse, and he sat and he watched it all day. And at the end of the day, he stood up and said, "The lighthouse is no good." The fog starts to come. The lighthouse bell rings, and the whistle blows, and the lights flash. It doesn't make any difference. The fog comes in anyway. Maybe law school teachers are something like that. And if you get fogged in by the time that I get through, I won't be surprised. It's a professional hazard. Let's review what we've been doing by talking about a case of the United States Supreme Court, an opinion written by Mr. Justice Douglas. I'm sure that many of you know quite a bit about Mr. Justice Douglas. You may even know that he was the son of a Methodist clergyman, and that he had been dipped in this way of life early in his life. And no matter what he said later, I'm sure that stains from that early introduction to Christianity in a clergyman's house remained with Douglas, so that his figures of speech and his way of thinking retained some of the coloration or the thought patterns, the processes that must have been part of his childhood. The King case was one in which a woman who had been receiving AFDC payments, aid for families with dependent children, she had a child living with her. She did not have a husband who was living in the house with her. She'd been receiving these payments, and the statutes of the state in which she was receiving the payments said that the payments were to continue on certain conditions. I hope that word condition now begins to mean something to you, especially those of you that I've had the pleasure of working with for this week. That is, we're going to give something to you, but only in the event that certain circumstances exist. Now, the United States government is not going to give her these payments because these circumstances exist, but they're going to give her these payments because she's needy if these circumstances exist. My bad analogy so far has been the dentist who knows that you've got a bad tooth and is willing to fix it free. Not because he's going to get paid because he knows you have no money, but rather because he doesn't want to see you in pain, and so he says to you that he will fix your tooth free, a gift, grace, on the condition that you come into the office and sit in the chair and open your mouth and don't bite him when he's working at it. Now, those are not bargains where he is buying freedom from being bitten by you. Those things are conditions that have to exist in order that the gift may be completed. And I have been trying to persuade you that God's covenant with man is a promise which is made upon condition, that God does not force people into the kingdom, nor does he put people into the kingdom by coercion or threat or punishment, and that his relationship to us, the Ten Commandments I'm talking about, is not a relationship of law with orders that we must obey or be punished, but rather that the Ten Commandments are the circumstances or the conditions, keeping your mouth open and not biting the hand that drills your tooth, that have to exist in order for God to deliver the blessing to you. Not a bargain for exchange, but rather circumstances under which the gift is possible to complete. Back to the King case. One of the conditions was that a person who had no funds and had a needy child and is receiving AFDC payments must not have living with her and her child in the house a man with whom she is having some kind of a relationship. This woman had a man living in her household, and therefore the state in which she lived terminated her payments. And she said that the payments ought not to be terminated. And that question, dressed in garb of a constitutional law problem, finally got to the United States Supreme Court. And Justice Douglas wrote an opinion in which he says, "Shall this woman's sin," the word he uses, "she is a sinner." I want you now to think about whether or not he's saying she is a wicked person who ought to be thrown into jail, or whether he is saying that she is a person who has not met conditions that are necessary to receive a gift, or whether he's saying that she is a person who has not organized her life and has not found the ability to live in a pattern which is most productive. What does he mean when he says sinner? He says the question is whether or not this woman's sin or her status as a sinner should deprive her of the money which her child and she needs to live. And he writes an opinion which says, no, it ought not to deprive her of those funds. And he does it in constitutional language, the verbiage and the speech patterns that a lawyer would use. And I won't bother you with that, since that's my language and not your language. It's enough to know that he says the question is that this woman has sinned. And he puts, incidentally, the word sin in quotation marks. Very interesting to find that in a decision of the United States Supreme Court. And then says, shall this sin preclude grace? He doesn't say grace. He says payments, AFDC payments. And decides, no, it should not. What I want you to tell me is whether that is or should be a dissenting opinion, or whether that is the majority opinion of the United States Supreme Court. You understand, there are 9 judges and they take a vote. And the side that has the most judges gets to write the majority opinion, and that's the decision. And then everybody else who doesn't like it gets to write a dissenting opinion, in which they say, boo, 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 bad theology or bad law. I want to know from you right now, the opinion that I've just given you from Douglas, was that a dissenting opinion from the opinion of the majority? Or was that the opinion of the majority of the court? I know. You tell me.
Dissenting
opinion. Why do you say that?
Douglas usually wrote dissenting opinions.
If you counted them all, you would find many, but not most. So if you did it on pure odds, you'd come out the other way. But yeah, he wrote a lot of dissenting opinions.
His Christian background
would lead him to be a dissenting judge. That is, the fact that he was
to see this differently.
Right? You're right. Incidentally, this was a dissenting opinion. Was the majority of the court correct legally here? Should the majority of the court have been unjust judges? Should they have said, well, I know what Congress told us to do. It wasn't Congress, it was a state legislature. I know what the state legislature said. State legislature said, we will furnish payments to a woman who has a child under certain conditions. This woman is not in that condition. I mean, she's not living in that circumstance. Therefore, she simply doesn't qualify. I mean, she bit the dentist. Therefore, she doesn't get paid. Should they have said, well, that was a silly thing to say in the first place, and ignore it?
No.
They ought to obey the law.
Yeah, they can only interpret law, they can't change law.
They only can interpret it. And so if it's clear, if anything ever is. It's no fair tilting what the legislature has done and to make the legislature graceful where it's meant to be less graceful. Maybe it's graceful to provide money to people who need it in a way, but they get to decide, not the judge. To have held as a majority along the opinion that Douglas was writing would make the majority of the court unjust?
No.
Not unjust. What would it be? Illegal? I know when I ask my students what illegal is, one of them told me one day that's a sick bird. Skipping the puns for a moment, would that not be illegal if the legislature has the right to make the decision and it makes the decision? And then the judge decides to go the other way. In a way, we don't put judges on the bench to follow their own whims, do we? Or do we?
That's the ambiguity you asked. You said we live with.
But yet we have the opinion from the justice in the balcony that this one is pretty clear. That the legislature said you pay under these circumstances, you do not pay if the woman is living with a man in the house. This one is living with a man in the house. Therefore, she doesn't fit the condition. Therefore, she doesn't get the payment. And I don't care what you think, Mr. Justice Douglas. You are just a judge. You are not the legislature. Yes,
but your question was the majority unjust or something else?
Should the majority have gone with Douglas? And I thought that I had a majority in this crowd saying that they should have.
No.
Oh, we got a split house. That's wonderful. We will now have a vote. Those of you who feel that this woman ought to get continued payments, please raise your hand. Oh, I see four Douglases. Five, okay. And those of you who feel that she ought not. And I see maybe a dozen and a half. I'm sorry about you people who didn't vote. You may not not vote. In this state and in most states, if you do not vote on the case, within a limited number of days after the matter has been put to you, you don't get paid. You would be surprised how many judges do not get their salary for a month or two because they are simply unable to bring themselves to the place where they can vote on a question where their gut is being sundered. Yeah, but you must. I'm sorry. You must. Harry Truman says, if you don't like the heat, get off the bench out of the kitchen. You have no choice. Yes, Dave?
I didn't vote because I wasn't ready to vote yet, I guess.
You sound like an academician. You're waiting for next. I'm no longer in active practice either.
Nothing in the days have transpired since I first heard this case, so that's fine. It seems to me, certainly the law is clear, and if you take the conditions seriously, then you must uphold the decision to give her aid. But then I guess the question would be whether one can place conditions on basic needs.
That was indeed the question, wasn't it, Dave? It's a constitutional matter of whether or not this is depriving a person of a constitutionally protected right. That was exactly the issue, you see, and you've put it in lawyer's language now for us. Yeah. And the majority of the court said yes. I mean, they said, yes, you may condition that payment in that way. It is not depriving a person of a constitutionally protected right. After all, the Constitution, as we have seen before, guarantees only minimum decency. Please never wish or pray that we should all live according to the Constitution. That is the bottom of the barrel. It's the least possible level of decency.
And are there are two issues. One issue being, what is justice? The other issue is, what is legal? And the two often don't meet.
At least what is right, we interpret. I didn't vote for that. Like, question, if you had asked under the law, denying her payment, I would have voted yes. But if you had said, ought the law to be changed, I would have voted yes again and changed the law.
Yes, ma'am.
Isn't one of the, I'm not a political scientist, but isn't one of the opportunities of the justice courts, the Supreme Court type layers, isn't that one of the checks and balances against laws, legislatures that may not have their heads screwed on straight?
Yeah. But judges are not armed with horses and lances to go around tilting windmills of their own free spirit. They are restrained by the Constitution.
Check in.
I mean, a judge is supposed to, you know, a few years ago, people were going around carrying signs saying, impeach Earl Warren. Mm-hmm. He thinks he's doing justice rather than applying the law. Who made you a judge over that question? The legislatures and Congress told you what to do. You do it the way you're told, not the way you think is fair. Some of you watch television. One of you last night mentioned that you've seen, that person has seen, maybe some others of you have seen, the series on the paper chase. The paper chase, a story of persons in law school. It's a full-length feature movie. Maybe some of you have seen it, the movie. Starts out with the same case that happens to use the same case book I do. Starts with the same case that I do. Let me put the case to you and see what you do with it. The case involved a young man, not yet an adult, but old enough to be out working, who took a hold of a live wire, an electrical wire, and badly burned his hand, and left him with a hand, right hand, which was almost useless to him, not quite, but almost, badly scarred, and couldn't be moved and manipulated and so forth. This was some years ago. Skin grafting was just coming into some recognition at that time, and an MD in the community wanted to learn something about skin grafting and wanted to try it out, if that's what the practice of medicine means. Or I shouldn't say things like that. The MD came to the young man and said, I think I can help you by doing a skin graft on your hand. The father of the boy, and the boy thought about it and said, will it work? And it is said that the MD at that point said, the operation will be relatively simple. In a few weeks, you will have 100% good hand, as usable as it was before. And the boy and his father then agreed that the skin graft ought to be made. The young man went into the hospital. The doctor grafted skin from the boy's chest onto the hand, and a little while later, the palm of his hand began to grow hair. That's an embarrassing situation. You have to get up in the morning and shave your face and shave your right hand. In addition to the fact that it had other difficulties with the graft, the hand was better. That is, it could be manipulated better than it was before the operation. But who likes to shake hands with people and have them burst into tickled laughter? The young man sued the medical doctor for the consequences of this operation. Should the medical doctor be put in jail? Anybody want to put him in jail?
No.
Now, just insult my intelligence and tell me why you don't want to put him in jail.
Well, is this a civil or is it a criminal action?
Yes. Depending on what kind of action you want to bring.
Well, I fail to see the criminal action.
Yeah.
You know something that we don't know. Please tell us.
You mean there is no statute of a legislature or a city or a county which says that
doing this kind of act is a criminal act.
I don't know of one.
There is none. There is none. And it violates no such basic premise of our lives together that we would be willing to say that this person has done a criminal act and ought to be punished. Okay? Dave?
Did the boy and the father know that the transplanted skin was coming from the chest?
I doubt it. The case doesn't tell me that, but I rather suspect they left that in the discretion of the surgeon. He may have told them, may not. I don't know. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I don't really see why he's suing, because there he had an arm that was useless, and now he has one that goes here. Well, that's really the lesser evil. I mean, I think he had no cause to sue, and so I don't think the doctor should be found guilty. Because he really gained. That's it.
Uh-huh. All right. A very telling point. Yes, ma'am.
Me? Yeah. He shouldn't have promised. He shouldn't have promised 100%.
From what you said, the result, they said it's especially experimental. Risk involved.
Didn't explain it all.
Right, and the way things work nowadays in the medical profession, the doctor, when he does surgery, has to explain all the risks and complications that can arise, even if they're minor.
Because of cases like the one we're talking about now. But now I have two ideas going right. One is the doctor shouldn't have said those things if he wasn't going to do it. If it wasn't going to be 100% perfect hand, he shouldn't have said so. And then I've got another idea, was that the doctor was negligent in not explaining and in not doing, you know, if he'd taken the skin from someplace else. Well, that raises another question. If you don't want to put the doctor in jail, would you be willing to hold the doctor liable for payments for all of the pain and the suffering and the embarrassment and the humiliation? Here's a young man who is either going to have the skin removed from his hand at another graft, and that might be very difficult to do, or else he's got to go through life with a hair-growing hand, which is not ideal. Are you willing to give him the amount of money which you think represents the pain, the suffering, the embarrassment, the humiliation? I'm talking about tort law at this moment. And the question that I want to ask you ultimately in this series is, has the doctor done a wrongful thing? Like running into somebody else with your automobile, or getting drunk and hurting them on the highway. Guilty of negligence. Those are really meaningful words. See, that word guilty. Sin here means wrong. And the money that we're going to award, how about that money that we are going to award, if we award any money here? Shall we think of that money as being punishment for the doctor for having been guilty of negligence, that is, engaging in wrongful action? Is the exercise that we are engaged in one of trying to make the medical profession shape up and not do things like that, just like we award damages in automobile accidents because we want to make the driver shape up and not drive that way? Is it a corrective function of the law to make people behave, or are we not engaged in punishment for wrongdoing but something else? Yes, sir.
It strikes me that the contract models that we used yesterday are useful, that the man with the damaged hand and the doctor got together and made a deal. You come to me, and in exchange for, or perhaps even if he's offered some conditions and guaranteed some results, and that some reparations are in order to the young man who will have had endured a certain amount of pain and has to live with his hairy hand for the rest of his life, or go through a certain amount of pain to repair the problem. And that in some way the promise was not fulfilled, and therefore, to achieve some sense of equity, it's appropriate that the balance
Are you all listening to the words that are coming out here? We first of all, we're getting some back and forth movement between this doesn't really sound like tort and negligence. Better that we go over and try this in contract, the agreement, the understanding between the parties. And then at the tail end, we start talking about whether we ought to be an unjust judge in one sense and do equity rather than follow a strict legal model. Now, if you didn't pick up on the first recital of the case, this skin graft was done at a time in which the art was new. And most doctors did not know, nor could this person have really understood, and he might have thought that skin from one part of the body put on the hand would behave like the skin on the palm of the hand does, for all I know. Maybe he thought about that, and in a way, the court, because we are of limited time, unless, as John Schramm says, you really want to stay another week and talk about this case. But at least in this case, the court said the doctor was not really negligent. His behavior met the standards of knowledge and skill in the practice at that time and place. Now, the next guy who does that is going to be negligent because you now know what the consequences of this are. So we X out our tort action, and we are not going to give damages for all the pain and all the suffering and all the humiliation that's involved. Those are tort damages, pain and suffering, humiliation, those sorts of things that that go beyond a contract remedy. Now let's think about the contract for just a moment, if there was a contract. Do you think there was a contract?
I agree. Yeah.
You think there was a contract? Somebody tell me, what do you think the undertaking of the two parties, that is, the patient and the doctor, what was the contractual relation between them? You know, by the time you get through, you won't even have to go to law school. We'll just give you a degree, and you can join Les's law firm.
Well, the doctor said he could fix his hand, so he let him work on it.
Did the patient agree to pay the doctor?
Yes, he did.
Okay,
yes,
then
he did.
The doctor agreed to work, and the patient agreed to pay. That's
do you right. think that the doctor promised to do his best? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that when the doctor said, well, you'll be in the hospital for a little while, and then you'll be home for a little while, but in a short time you'll be fine, and your hand will be a 100% good hand, would you have believed the doctor when he said that?
Yes.
You would have wanted to. Would you have believed the doctor when he said that?
No. Yes. Possibly, because if this was totally brand new and nobody really knew, sure, it makes sense. You take skin from one place. And
when the doctor comes in and says, well, you do look sick, but that's all right. You're going to be better soon. Is he promising you that you're going to be better soon? Or is he just saying, be of good spirit, good cheer, stay in there and fight, and we're with you, and it's all going to be reassuring chatter, you know, like the used car salesman who says, this is a great car.
Your hand will be 100% after this operation doesn't sound to me like reassuring chatter. It's
sounds
more
like
than that. It's a statement that my skill is equal to the task.
If I can use a word which we all misuse, it was a warranty, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I promise you, I assure you, I warrant that you will have a 100% usable hand. Yes, Dave?
Well, it seems to me that in terms of contracts that you do, as somebody pointed out, have the patient's agreement to pay for services. The service rendered is not the hand healing or the promise of the hand healing. The service rendered is the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an act for which you're contracting in a sense, but it's inappropriate to say that this guarantees it's going to be healing.
One bought from the surgeon his best efforts, and one realizes that no surgeon can guarantee the results, and it's unreasonable to assume that the surgeon can or does. The minds didn't meet. It's more like chickens than it is like peaches.
I'm introducing you to the weird way that lawyers think about things.
Well, I think that's
is a hairy hand more like a chicken or is it more like a peach?
It's more like a peach, clearly.
In this case, the doctor made a serious professional mistake making a promise like that. I'm in a profession where I don't make promises like that. I can't make that kind of guarantee, but he made it, and that made it part of the contract at this point.
The other issue is, by making that statement, the patient now has no need to open another option. There are options for the patient to go to a specialist, perhaps, that was well-skilled in this and could have told them right.
Not at that time.
Well,
may I ask you now to think a theological thought. Was this a covenant in the Old Testament model? Or in the New Testament, New Covenant? Or was this a bilateral contract? Let me change the question. Are you in a position where both parties are struggling for advantage?
Yes.
And to enforce the understanding of one is to harm the other, of necessity, because they are in an adversarial relationship to each other. Situation which is impossible in a covenant. You know, if the buyer of the peaches is willing to pay full price even for inferior product, the seller of the peaches cannot be hurt. He is receiving all that he anticipated for less. Covenant. That's my relationship to God in the covenant. God, in my opinion, never makes a bilateral contract with me and says, Ricky, if you'll do such a good job of giving lectures at Holden, you know, I promise you that I'll let you in the gate. God simply does not make contracts with us that way, nor do I think God says, Ricky, if you will promise me that you will faithfully observe all the Ten Commandments, that in consideration of the fact that you've done such a splendid job, I will let you in the gates. My relationship with God simply is not bilateral contract, promise for promise. Well, we've got to move on here, but I will not be permitted to rest in quiet. My wife will see to that, unless I tell you now what the court did. The court said in this case that no one really ought to misunderstand the words of the surgeon in this situation as being words of guarantee or promise, that they were words of reassurance and encouragement. That's a very debatable point, isn't it? We've been debating it. And somebody had to decide whether it was idle chatter, you know, that's okay, buck up, be happy, everything's gonna be fine, it's a great car, or whether these were words of I promise you, believe me, trust me, rely on me, I'm warranting and guaranteeing. They held no. Suppose that they had found that these were words of promise. What remedy would you have given? I'm supposing now, hypothetically. Suppose that they were words of promise and the doctor had breached his promise. Is he a sinner?
Yes.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do about it?
It seems to me that the kind of contract then would be the doctor is promising to perform the surgery with these results. The man agrees to pay him.
Yes.
The doctor does his best.
Yes.
But through no fault of his own, the results aren't what he or the patient expected. He
turned out to be stewing hens rather than fryers.
He has fallen short.
Yes.
And isn't that sin?
He's not done as well as he could have, and that's sin. Any case of an inadequate performance is, quote, sin. Now be very careful how you use that word. At least be as intelligent as Douglas. Because I know a lot of people who think that sin is the violation of a law rather than thinking that sin is an inadequate living out of a status relationship with God. It's a falling short. And I know, although I do not speak Greek, I could cross-examine Dave at this point, I know that in Scripture The word that we translate, the word sin in our language is a translation of 7 or 9 different words in Scripture, some of which mean you have just violated a law and you ought to go to jail. And in other places, the word means you have not done what was hoped for and what was expected. You nipped the dentist. And then comes the question as to whether or not the dentist will excuse the non-occurrence of the condition and say, you rascal, you bit me, and therefore I'm under no compulsion to fix your tooth free for you, but man, I can't stand you suffering, I'm going to give you another chance. Now don't you bite me again. I'm coming in to fix that tooth, because the love of God is persistent like a hound that follows me through my life and offers itself to me again and again and again. God persists in his faithfulness and his grace, even though I haven't qualified under the specifications or the conditions or the circumstances of the covenant. Now watch that. There's a lot more to be said about the case of the hairy hand, but the bell's going to get us. And I've got one more rack that I want to put you on before we get out of here. This is sort of a synthesis of cases that arise with considerable frequency in this state, the state of Washington, where I read the sheets, the advance sheets, reported decisions. Therefore, I'm more familiar with them than I am in other states, but a case arises all over the United States. So I'm now going to give you a synthesis of a very common case, very frequent occurrence. A person has a house, a piece of land that the person wants to sell. And because the buyer can't pay cash, certainly is the situation today, there are very few of us that can reach into our left pocket and come up with $150,000 for the house. They do creative alternative financing. I think that's the kind of slogan that I read in the newspapers these days. One of the creative alternative forms of financing that's been used for a few hundred years is what's known as a conditional sales contract. That is to say, the seller says to the buyer, you want this house, and I realize you can't pay cash, and you don't want to go down to the bank and borrow the money because it's going to cost you 21% interest or whatever the circumstances are, and maybe you couldn't get the loan anyway. So what we'll do is this. I, the seller, will permit you, the buyer, to go into possession of the house now, into occupancy of the house, and you promise me in a contract that you will pay me so many dollars per month. Let's say $500 a month, and you will continue paying me $500 a month until such time as the entire obligation with interest is paid, and at that point I will convey title of the house to you, and then for the first time you will be the owner of the house. It will be yours. Between now and that happy day, you will be living in the house, but you won't own it. I will own it. And in the event that you do not pay, comes now a great big old condition. In the event that you do not pay, I may keep the money that you have already paid me, and also may keep the property. That's what those conditional sales contracts say, you know. The seller keeps the money that's been paid, and is also going to keep the title to the house and is the owner of the house. Okay? You got the scenario? Okay. Surprisingly, in many of these cases, the buyer fails to make the payment. Now, it may be it's because he's a nasty person and doesn't want to make the payments. Or it may be because his wife and all 12 children have come down with the roaring mumps and he can't make the payment. He got fired, and there's no fault of his, the factory closed, and you know, it's a whole bad scene. Fire is as innocent as the new driven snow of any kind of wrong. He just doesn't have the money. He's a screaming widow with a child, and if Douglas were around, why, Douglas would weep copiously. And, you know, the whole thing. So the seller the house says, you didn't make the payment. And the buyer says, Sob, I know I didn't. The next month, it's the same story. Still not getting paid. And then the seller says to the buyer, I'm sorry about this, but you can't stay in that house if you don't pay for it, because I need the $500 a month. And therefore, I'm going to keep the money that you paid me. I'm going to forfeit your interest. And I'm going to ask you to leave. At which point, the buyer of the house says, I don't like that. You can ask me to leave as much as you like, but I'm not leaving. I'm staying right here. And the seller says, you don't have, watch me now, ladies and gentlemen, and see whether or not I'm doing this wrong. The seller says, but you don't have any legal right to stay there. And the buyer says, right, so I don't have any legal right. So what are you going to do about it? And the seller says, I will ask you to leave. And the buyer says, and I'll tell you to go to California. So at that point, the seller goes down to the judge and says, Judge, does this man have a legal right to stay in that house? And the judge says, no, doesn't have a legal right. Uh-huh. Then, Judge, will you please order the sheriff? And the sheriff won't do anything about it, of course, until the judge tells him to do something about it. So the seller says to the judge, then, Judge, will you please ask the sheriff to go out and remove the buyer from the house, take him out of there? You know, the seller can't do that himself. The seller may not resort to violence. That's what law is about. The seller may not employ his own army and go out and drive the buyer out of the house by force, violence. It's got to go through legal process. And the judge says, now let's see. I've already said that the buyer doesn't have a legal right to stay in that house, and you now want me to throw him out, don't you? I wonder if I should do that. All right. You judges of the law, will you be unjust? What are you going to do? Order the sheriff to go throw the buyer out?
No.
I think this may vary from state to state.
Yeah, better than that, it varies from judge to judge.
Well, I think it all depends upon whether you got your law degree at Harvard or Yale.
What would the differences be?
I had a very interesting lawyer who always liked to come up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon visible to me. And he had a large firm, and he said, you know, the dean at Yale is getting at me. Because I won't take anything of my
graduates.
He says, why don't you take some of my graduates? And the attorney said, well, the reason I don't take any of your graduates, and would prefer them from Harvard or Stanford.
Or Michigan.
Michigan.
That's another tough nut place, yeah.
Is that too many of your judges deal on intent instead of actuality.
Yeah.
They don't read the law accurately.
I mean, we're getting literal construction over here, coming out of Harvard and Michigan, and we're getting grace and fat-headedness coming out of Yale, or justice, if you like, or mercy, or equity. All right, do you come from Harvard or Yale? You know, I'm sorry, you cannot refuse to answer me. Because if you do, I'll cut off your pay. And you will eat no more. Yes, sir.
Is there precedent set, like previous cases of this sort?
Yes, sir.
What's the decision in their case?
Well, there are lots of cases decided here, many of them.
Same situation.
Which I'm going to disclose from you at the moment. I'm sorry, going to conceal from you at the moment. I will disclose what the judges are doing later. But right now, you've got a case of first impression. In my hypothetical, nobody ever had this problem before. Not even in Scripture.
Is there against some sort of...
Excuse me, just one moment. And if it's a case of first impression with you, so you can't go on what some other judge did. And now what do you do?
Okay, does the law spell out what you did then?
The law, that is, legally, yet I'm trying to underline that and make it sound like legalisms, the worst of everything, says that the seller has the right to keep the money and to regain the property. That's his legal right. Question is whether or not you're going to do it, or whether you're going to pull a Douglas on us.
Is it up for interpretation?
Well, judges have a lot of flex in the end of the whip shaft. They sure do, you know. Judges have a lot of opportunity to use their discretion and do justice, if that's different than doing law. Yes, ma'am.
If I was the judge, I would give the buyer a little grace period to come up with the money. If they couldn't at that end of the period, then I'd give the seller the legal right to go in and remove all their personal effects out of the house.
Give them 6 months to bring the contract up to to speed.
Something like that. And then you have the contract. See, okay, you have the legal right at the end of this period, they have to come up with money to go into their home and take out all the personal effects.
Okay, Mr. Buyer, legally you are in default on your contract right now. However, this is the day that I feel merciful and gracious as a judge. Therefore, I'm going to give you 6 months in which you can catch up with your payments and pay a little interest on the money that you didn't pay, time you should have paid it. And if you've brought it up to full payment by that time, I'll let you stay there. If you don't, for whatever the reason, even though you break the other leg and bash your head on the wall and all your cows die, no matter what the reason, don't you come back here and ask me to be fat-headed again. This is your last shot. You've got 6 months. You didn't say that. I said that. And if you don't bring it up to performance in 6 months, then I'm going to send the sheriff out. He's going to remove your property and remove you, and using such forces as necessary, as sheriffs may do, and let the seller regain the property and keep the payments. Yes, sir.
I think if I were the judge, it would make some difference if the buyer had been making payments for a year or two, or whether he'd been making payments for 20 years.
Why?
Because of the past record and how much, what percentage of that total thing that he had paid that he would be entirely out of.
The buyer may owe more of it than the seller.
Entirely possible. We can hypothesize perfectly fairly that he's down to the very last payment after 25 years, or we can say that this failure to pay comes on the first payment.
You know, for the last payment, it would be very unjust. It would be unjust enrichment to deny the buyer the
property.
Justice now. I don't know whether you all got that or not. You ought to get a just result, notwithstanding, though.